Alright, should we start? Okay, well let's kick off. So a couple of little caveats. I'm not a cycling expert, and I gather from some of the conversations we have at the meetings that you guys are. So if I make things of factual error, I will be happy to amend, correct, whatever. I'll be quite happy for you to correct me. So, I just wanted to put that out there. A little bit about me. I'm a bike mechanic. I'm a specialist wheel builder. So I spend... Pardon?
Is that Tuesday?
On the left, yeah. I was a little skinnier. I'm a cycling enthusiast. I love bikes. I've got about 10, but I'm not allowed to have any more. Hence, we don't own a garage. And, but I'm very interested in cycling history, and I'm particularly interested in wheels because I spend every day looking at them and thinking about them and working on them. So that's a little bit about me. Question. Does anyone know what that is?
It's Egyptian, isn't it?
Yeah, very good.
Were you talking about the wheel or the painting?
Mostly the wheel, but you could look at the painting.
It's an Egyptian chariot wheel.
Yeah, well done.
Is it?
It is. It looks pretty fancy, doesn't it? So that's, that is Tutankhamun's chariot wheel.
Wow.
There you go. That's from 1332 BC.
Amazing.
Advanced manufacturing from the ancient world, and that is a wheel that will be ridden in the Olympics on the velodrome this evening. Not hugely dissimilar.
Was that old wheel made the same way as the modern cartwheel, you know, by
spinning,
or can't you tell?
I can't tell. I can say that you can see by the sort of binding around the spokes and the axle that it is a kind of composite resin of some sort. But in terms of how it was made, I'm unfortunately not an expert. So I can't advise you on things ancient Egyptian. So this is a... Has anyone read the book about the bike?
Yeah.
Great. This is a little quote that inspired me. I'll read it to you. You can have a bicycle without derailleur gears or brakes. It's called a track or fixed gear bicycle. If pressed, you can have a bicycle without a bottom bracket, sprocket chain wheel, cranks or pedals. Take all this and you strip the bicycle back to the bare essential parts of the Dresin. Take away the wheels, though, you do not have a bicycle. So a big part of my interest in wheels is recognising that they're a fundamental part of what a bicycle is. The very word bicycle, to wheel. So a little overview of my talk. My experience of reading a lot of the books on cycling history is it tends to focus mostly on changes in the bicycle frame and drive chain technologies that have evolved over hundreds of years, or at least 170, 80 odd, depending on when you start counting. So often the wheel is the invention that, you know, one of humankind's great inventions is already sort of taken for granted as something that just comes along. Despite this, I will argue that the bicycle wheel has constantly evolved and been reinvented throughout its history. Finally, I will argue that the technological innovations in bicycle wheels have technological significance far beyond the scope of just bicycles. I think it's fair to say we could say that for bikes in general, but I'm just going to put that out there. So quick overview also of what I'm going to be talking about tonight. I'm not going to try and present a grand history of every little thing that ever happened in bicycle wheel technology. I'm just going to pick a couple. Hopefully I won't talk for too long and we can have a chat, because I'd be really interested in hearing what you guys have to say as well. Let's kick off. the radial ball bearing. 1869, French bicycle mechanic Jules Perry Souriret is said to have painted it, the ball bearing. It was installed on the bicycle that James Moore won in one of the first bicycle races, Paris-Rouen, in 1869. There is an argument amongst cycling historians about whether that was the first or the second bicycle race. I'm not so concerned. What I think is interesting was that we can see at the very beginning of bike racing, there are attempts to make wheels go faster. And the addition of ball bearings was one major part of that. However,
so can I ask a question? So ball bearings were not used before then on anything?
No, so they were. So there is a Welsh inventor who had invented ball bearings in carts, and people have said that Galileo, Leonardo invented ball bearings. Rolling elements of various descriptions have been part of technology for thousands of years, but the actual ball bearing, as it's currently known, is attributed to this guy here. So it's a bit of a loose one, and a lot of the stuff I'll be talking about, the pneumatic tyre, it's another one of those ones where who really invented it? Few arguments. But my key point here is that the ball bearing technology was bang on at the very start of the bicycle. Interestingly enough, with the Souriret hub, at that time, the quality of metal wasn't good enough. Steel wasn't hard enough for the ball bearings to last. So both the races, which the bearings run along, and the balls eventually started to grind down and the wheel didn't spin very nicely at all. So even though they were successful, they didn't prove to be durable at this time. It would be many decades before ball bearing technology would advance to allow proper bearings in bicycle wheels. And that's something we probably all know. No guesses what that is. The remarkable thing about the cup and cone, and I don't know who invented it, we'll just take that, you know, whether this is the same version as what we originally had here, I cannot say. What a remarkable thing that it's proven to be robust all these years. We can still find brand new bicycles with that. It's exactly the same design today. A couple of other just little tidbits. Some of you will be familiar with that. This is a MaxiCar hub design from the 1950s with magneto bearings, which were a sort of high-speed industrial bearing. And they pretty much were the ultimate bearing of their day. I think you would say that they would give contemporary industrial cartridge bearings a fairly good run for their money in terms of the quality of the hubs that were being made in France at this time. Not to be outdone, however, this is from very recent times. This is the Gossico hubs, which is made by the Kondo Machine Corporation. This business makes jet engines, which have to operate at incredible speeds. The main design feature of this hub was that they were trying to separate the ball bearings, that these are industrial cartridge bearings, from any axial loads that would affect their performance. So they have these little fingers that allows the axle to flex without affecting the wheel flanges. It's quite remarkable. The hub set costs $2,800 if anyone wants to buy. That's just for the hubs.
Yeah. Did you bring one today?
I did, yeah. Okay, so we're going to go way back again. I didn't want to talk too much about hubs, so a little bit of a time warp. 1874. We all recognise the guy on the right. Heard of him? No? No, I didn't think so. Wrong crowd. Anyway, so the tangential spoked wheel is attributed to James Starley, the father of the bike industry. And from a design perspective, it was very clear that any wheel that involves a torsional load is better at managing those loads when the spokes are tangentially laced, as opposed to the radial spoked wheel, which we're all familiar with and was more common on earlier wheels.
Adrian, I'll ask a question, I know the answer, but
please.
Why is tangential spokes better than a radial?
Well, it's when the load is being transmitted through the flanges, it comes at an angle as it leaves the flange, and basically it's pulling the hub in a direct line. It's pulling the rim to go with the flange. If the angle of stress is rotationally forward, and the spoke is going straight up, then the spoke flexes first before it pulls the rim. So it's allowing for a more efficient transmission of load. Do any of you recognise that bike? Now, just going back to my previous slide, 1874 is the date of the patent for the tangent spoke wheel. 3 years before, this is the Ariel bicycle, which I believe was fairly significant in bike history. Is that a fair comment? No. Anyway, okay. It's one of the major Starley-era bikes. If you notice on here, there are these big lever arms going through the hub with this little bar here. So you can kind of see that there's a bit of a... Can you see how that would be helping the torsional load as you pedal forward? I just thought it was an interesting point that Starley, 3 years before he'd come up, the invention was already thinking about this issue of torsional load. Okay, so there's the Starley patent. A little bit more from the era. He died not long after it, but not that long before he died, managed to knock out the differential geared hub as well. So he just sort of thought he might just, you know, score a couple more runs before he went out. So it's pretty hard to fathom just what a massive impact he's had. Many historians have argued that that's the basis of many early motor gears as well. Okay, and there's his nephew, I believe, John Kempt. We're gone forward a decade, 1885, and we have... Well, I don't know if we can call that a diamond frame, but I'm not going to argue about that. I'm not a frame expert, but definitely we've got tangentially spoked wheels, and from this day onwards, it's pretty much been the norm. Okay, we all know what that is. So there is an argument over the history. Pardon?
Sorry, that's Mal Dillon.
That's Mal. The Mogabill, did you say?
No,
one of our members. Oh, okay. It does. So we know John Dunlop invented it. His name is synonymous with tyres. There is another argument over who invented it. Thompson, another guy who, from about 40 years earlier, had come up with an invention, but it never really succeeded as an invention and never really reached that level of commercial success. So Dunlop was a vet, if you hadn't sort of heard some of the history. Don't know if he just was used to pulling things apart and stitching them back up together. But he's credited with inventing the pneumatic tyre, which would revolutionise bicycles and practically any other form of wheel transport since.
I'm sorry, Adrian, why?
Why?
Because he's...
But what makes pneumatic tyres so wonderful on a wheel?
Well, they're effectively suspension. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the tyre is allowing us to travel and maintain speed while there are irregularities in the road surface.
Most roads were irregular. Yeah.
So, I mean, interestingly enough, back in the day when you would have had the high wheelers, the larger the wheel, the less you notice road shocks. I have ridden penny farthings, as you've seen. I can't say they're the most comfortable vehicle to ride all day, but having those large wheels certainly didn't hurt compared to a smaller wheeled bicycle. We all know Dunlop tyres, they're fairly synonymous with anything tyre. That's in a poster from Australia, that's just a very old one from back in the day. Schrader. We've heard of the word, but there was a man behind it, August Schrader. He was a rubber merchant from New York. I believe he was of German heritage. He invented the Schrader valve, although I believe his son, who was George Schrader, really sort of fixed it up a bit after he died. But he was approached by a number of bicycle manufacturers saying, we're having problems with our valves, can you fix it? And he fixed it, and his invention is pretty much the most common valve found in the world to this day. Moving along, the aluminium, I had to check my spelling. Well, they always give you the wrong spelling. Constrictor are generally regarded as being one of the earliest. They're an English manufacturer of makers of aluminium rims. One of the interesting things I found out from reading up on them was that they weren't really adopted by the racing cyclists for some time. It was largely the touring cyclists, ones with a little bit more money, who were pushing to get the sort of lightest, best quality rims. But I think as early as 1926 were some of the first alloy rims, and they were almost half the weight of some of the wooden and steel rims of the era. Not long after that, Mavic and Fiam, who were developing rims at that time, both claimed to have invented the double eyeleted rim at the same time, as to a matter of hours between when they got it to the patent office. It's apparently understood that Longhi, Bruno Longhi, the Italian inventor, beat Mavic by a couple of hours, but they let them use it anyway. So double eyeleted alloy rims. The interesting thing, I guess, is that we're in the 1930s, and in many respects from this time, the developments in the rim probably wouldn't change that significantly for some time. The bicycle wheel, as a racing wheel at least, was fairly advanced by the 1930s.
So the racing wooden rim, and when does that...
Now, the racing wooden rim, I'm going to leave that to you guys to provide your expertise, but what I do know is that they were around for much longer. In fact, pretty much every rim was a wooden rim until there were some steel rims and some wooden ones. But the racing cyclists were using the wooden rims predominantly. And I'm not sure exactly when they disappeared, but it's fairly well understood that at least into the 1940s, people were racing the Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of France on wooden rims. But eventually, once other riders cottoned on that the aluminium rims were superior, that everyone jumped over. But yeah, wooden rims is an area of technological history that I think still needs to be written about. I've jumped forward a little bit too far. So we're getting a massive space jump here. The free hub body, 1986.
When it came in, the cassettes?
Absolutely. The year. No? Okay. Well, this is another interesting historical fact, and I'm sure some of you will know. Free hub body designs had existed well before this. I've seen photos in some of the old French catalogues from the 1950s that showed hubs with separate gear systems that would basically the cogs could slide over a freehub boarding type system. So they definitely did predate it. I guess what's significant about this is that this was the first time it really skyrocketed, and it, the three wheel as we know it disappeared. So the freehub body was invented primarily by Shimano, and pretty soon all the other hub manufacturers jumped on board. One of the things that some people misunderstand about the concept behind the freehub body was essentially before you had a freehub body, when you had a freewheel, your inner side hub bearings would be located under the drive side flange. What that would mean is that all this section of axle would be unsupported. Bent axles were a very common problem. Freehub body seemed to solve that to some degree. And I'll just go flick forward.
I had a cyclo thing with a detachable block.
Yeah.
But that still had the bearing in the side. So you're quite right, even though it did that job.
Yeah.
It didn't have the correct bearing.
Yeah.
Better hub.
Yeah.
It was quick release. So.
Yeah. Just an example of the benefit. I'm going to flick back. This is from the catalogue, the Shimano product catalogue of 1986. It's interesting in this period of transition, you see them selling both their freewheel and their freehub together as a sort of optional package, and they were quite clever in the way they marketed it. That it allowed for that transition to occur without sort of upsetting people too much. Another interesting thing, and we were talking a little bit about Sumtour earlier, and Shimano, when they brought out the freehub body, was exactly the same time as they brought in index shifting, SIS. And these two revolutions in sort of bicycle performance, plus Sumtour kind of missing the boat on index shifting and having a few other stuff-ups, really sort of signaled the time in which Shimano would come to dominate the bicycle market globally. Mm-hmm. They kicked a lot of goals in the 80s. The quality of their work was amazing. And it's just an interesting period of history where we've transitioned from a time in where there were multiple component manufacturers to large systems of parts that are designed to work together. As a curiosity, I've put in the bladed spoke, and I'm wondering if any of you guys can help me, because I think when I went to the museum exhibition when they had the Steel Bishop bike, I'm pretty sure he had bladed spokes on his bike.
I think it did, yeah.
And that was from the 70s at Munich.
It was 1983, wasn't it?
Okay. I would like to go and see that bike again and try and identify the brand of spoke.
It's a radial.
Yep. Yeah, on the rear. It was partly... One side was crossed. I did check that. It was two cross drive side, radial non-drive. But anyway... bladed spokes were invented, I guess, in the pursuit of performance gains, trying to make spokes more aerodynamic. Also, stiffer spokes that would allow you to build wheels with less spokes to some degree. Hoshi were a Japanese company that were one of the first to experiment with bladed spokes, but they ran into a bit of a problem. Can anyone guess what that was?
Can't get through the hole.
Yeah. So they had bladed spokes that were approximately a millimetre thick, but 3 millimetres wide, or however you want to think of it. So they were too thick to fit in standard spoke holes, so they used what was called a Z-bend, which would just sort of curl in and just sort of hook into the flange hole. Apparently that didn't work very well. And prone to breaking, but they look quite spectacular. In the 90s, Suppam invented the CX-ray spoke, And essentially that was a very fine bladed spoke where the diameter of the spoke was the thickness was 0.9 of a millimetre and the width of the bladed section was 2.3, which is exactly the width to fit in a standard spoke hole. And that was a fairly advanced form of spoke manufacturing technology. A lot of people don't realise that what actually goes into spokes isn't just a piece of wire that's strung out, but multiple processes of forging, cold working the spokes. And the benefit of this is that when you have multiple manufactured cold working processes, you actually are strengthening the spoke at a sort of crystal microscopic structure. Am I making any sense?
Yeah. So is this like a double bucket spoke?
Yeah, so the CX-ray is essentially what would be a 1.5 millimeter butted spoke that then gets flattened.
So it starts
itself as a 2 millimeter wire spoke. It gets double butted to 1.5 and then it gets flattened. So there's all those cold working processes are making it incredibly strong. So 1994 was an interesting period of time. I guess if we think of the history of cycling, the 90s were the period where it stopped just being a very sort of Eurocentric sport to entering the sort of post-Greg LeMond space age of technology and drugs. but the development of wheels at that time changed massively. And Mavic are generally regarded as one of the first companies to move away from the idea of thinking about the wheel as a mixture of components that would be chosen to the wheel as a system that would be optimized for performance. So the Cosmic and the Cosmic Carbone, which was their carbon version of it, were two of their very advanced what we'd call wheel systems. These were essentially moving into what we call proprietary wheels. Essentially, the hubs, the spokes, the rims, the nipples, everything was designed to work together. And there's some pictures of some. Some of you may recognise them, some of you may not. But these are some of the wheels that are very, very common today amongst racing cyclists. And the benefits of them is they have made incredibly strong and light and aerodynamic wheels. They've also made incredibly disposable wheels. You break a rim, you break a spoke, you throw the wheel in the bin pretty much. Oh. That's how they work because the companies will typically only keep parts for a short period of time and the cost of repairing them is greater than the time value of buying a new wheel.
So you don't repair those?
I do sometimes. It's a borderline.
But if you get a fracturing one,
yep.
And it doesn't have to be broken, it's just a
cracked rim.
How do you repair a composite material?
Oh, it's a composite, you wouldn't repair it. There are frame composite repairs, but for a rim, generally, no, you'd throw it away. Yeah, but even if you break a spoke in one of these, it can be very difficult. Yeah.
Just from the point of view of parts availability, I suppose.
Yeah, often parts are only kept available for 1 or 2 years, if they're available at all. And then if you can't find the same part after a couple of years, then the wheel can't be fixed. Because it's not a standard, there's no standard part that you can replace it with.
Yeah, we'll be buying our old bike soon. I can't afford all these fancy modern bikes.
Well, I mean, I guess an interesting thing about coming back, I guess, from a club perspective also is that we can sort of wonder how many old wheels will be left in the future because old rims and old hubs can last many years and rebuildings and relacings, and you know, rims get damaged often, you can't do much but throw them away, but hubs can last an incredible long time. In future, it's hard to say how many of these wheels will be left, because most of them will go to the bin. So I've got a last kind of thing to talk about, I guess, is the carbon wheel. And I was trying to think, can I date the carbon wheel? And I just thought, no, I can't, because it's been around a damn long time. Some of the earliest images of the carbon wheel come back to Francesco Moser in his sort of famous world hour record attempts from the early 80s. I guess the thing to make note of is that the wheels that he was actually riding were not carbon per se. They were standard wheels with a carbon fairing, essentially. It wasn't until much later in the 90s that carbon wheels, fully carbon composite wheels, became more common. On the right, we've got a picture of Jan Ulrich riding some German lightweight wheels. If you look at any photos of the Pro Peloton at that time, there's not that many riders on them. Most of them, you see the rider next to him, are still riding traditional box section wheels. And that was, you know, you'll notice in this picture also, he's still riding a Pinarello aluminium frame. He's not riding a carbon frame. But the carbon wheel was adopted very early. In fact, it's even said that when he had a mountain time trial, he got a special carbon wheel made for him that didn't even have brake tracks, because he could save weight on the rim by not having a brake track, and he obviously didn't need a brake to ride up a hill.
Up at the top, these carbon would give you a lot more wind resistance, say like a crosswind or something, you know. How does that affect your performance in a race?
Yeah.
When you can't get the winds going through your...
The fairings have never caught on.
Yeah, not full fairings, no. So you're absolutely right. There's optimal and less optimal conditions in terms of crosswinds, and a huge part of the development of modern carbon rims has come from aerodynamics and studying the way in which air flows over rims, and they've changed shape a lot, but generally you will not see riders working with rims past a certain depth, and typically nominally that depth, I'm not going to give any hard and fast rules, but not much more than 50 mil.
So is that why the solid wheels are more suitable for track where you have no wind?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they still don't have them on the front, except in time trial events, when they don't have to move up and down, because of even on a track race, say a messy Madison race or something, you still need to have sudden movements, and having that wind on your front wheel affect your steering is an issue, but the rear wheel is less of an issue because the air is already interrupted once it passes your body. This is just a little aside. I'm not sure how many racing fans we've got here tonight, but in 2009 Tom Boonen was the last rider to win Paris-Roubaix on an aluminium 32 spoke Ambrosio Nemesis rim. Interestingly, up until that point, it is believed that no carbon wheel had ever finished the race. Such was the fear of carbon wheels amongst the professional peloton. However, the following year, our recently retired Fabian Cancellara... No, he hasn't retired yet. Has he retired? He's almost retired. He won Paris-Roubaix on a set of Zip 303 carbon tubulars with 20 front spoke and 24 rear. I guess we can say that...
They're carbon fibre spokes as well?
No, they're steel spokes. I think we can say from this sort of period onwards, which is ridiculously contemporary. I mean, I remember watching this race. I remember watching both of them. It's kind of interesting, I think, that even though carbon wheels have been adopted in the peloton for a long time, there was still a lot of resistance amongst riders, and I think once it was proven that they could win Roubaix, and so every year since this year, Roubaix has been won on a set of carbon wheels. Yep.
As an aside, I remember that 2010 race, mm-hmm. they x-rayed his bike after because they couldn't believe he took off 30
a big breakaway, yeah.
from the end and did it on his own.
Yep.
Left everyone for
and the aerodynamics would have been an important part of their game plan for this race.
They thought he had a motor in.
So
this Tom Brennan, he's got a 32 Spockers up front and rear.
Front and rear, okay. Yeah. And a 20mm by about 18mm rim. Very traditional, Merckx era rim wheel. He's Belgian, so he's traditional.
Questions?
I've got a question.
Yes.
How do they actually tension the spokes on those one piece rims?
I don't actually know. There's a video of how Mad Fibre do it, and it involves a whole lot of weights and moulds, but I believe essentially it's not tensioned in the same way. I mean, carbon fibre is in itself a kind of tensioned fibre, like a tyre casing. It's a weave that has a resin that holds it and gives it structural rigidity. But in the sense of truing and tensioning,
why do you reckon some of the old French hubs they had slots cut in them so on the drive side you could change a spoke without having to take the cluster off?
Yeah.
I wonder why they didn't use that sort of technology to use the bladed spokes.
Yeah, I think there was this thing, I think they call it butterfly sort of holes. They allowed you, so if you had like a free wheel and you needed to put a spoke in but it got in the way, you could slide it in.
Sturm is like that, Sturm Archer.
I've seen that a few times, but that's a good point. They could have probably done that.
Probably it weakens the hub, doesn't it?
It does weaken the hub because the holes are larger, but it still seemed to work. So, yeah, good point. Someone else may have owned the paint. I don't know.
He's still running with the Farthings have hollow spokes.
I remember you mentioning that at our last meeting. I've never come across a hollow spoke, and I'd love to know more about them.
Oh, well, one of our club members has got some there. I've read a bit about them. I'm not quite sure.
And these very long spokes are pennies?
For penny farthings, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Bikes I've got are 54 inches.
Yeah.
So half that sort of thing, you have an idea of the length. But they were hollow.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how they rolled them and joined them. I'm a bit curious.
I'm
about
curious
the
too.
And how they locked them in at a chin.
Yeah.
But I was only reading a little bit about last week, and it's hard to believe that you can get a spoke, a hollow spoke.
Yeah, I mean, when you mentioned that the last meeting, I was pretty astounded. So yeah, if yourself or Mal's able to bring one in, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you very much, Andrew.
No worries.